You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on February 23rd, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the politics of soccer hooliganism and Egypt's intervention in Libya. Then, Sasha joins me to discuss the Koch brothers in the 2016 U.S. elections. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Great to be here.
Yeah, we couldn't record again last week because of the endless
storms
in Boston.
7 feet of snow, yo.
Yeah, but we are back, and we've got several topics to cover today. One of the topics that we've covered a little bit in the past, kind of in parallel with some other topics like Islamophobia in Germany and Sweden, political activism in the Arab world related to soccer, is sort of this intersection of sports, but particularly soccer and politics, and especially sort of extremist politics, so to speak. Even setting aside the politics, I think European football or soccer has a kind of a reputation for being a little bit out of control in terms of fan behavior, people getting stabbed and stuff like that, even when there's no sort of political level to it. But we also talked about how the neo-Nazi types in Germany, in certain areas of Germany, were kind of mobilizing around, you know, football games and stuff to be organizing for their agenda, which is more or less banned in Germany. So some of you might have heard, because it even made the U.S. headlines, about this incident that happened in Paris with fans of the Chelsea Football Club, which I think we had also talked about Chelsea, if I remember correctly, in a segment recently on the radio show, although that was for other reasons. Nate, why don't you walk us through what the incident was and kind of the bigger picture here?
Right. So there was an away game for the UEFA Champions League, which is like where the top teams from various leagues all play each other in sort of a all-European competition. And so fans travel across Europe in order to have away support, and often that can actually lead to various disturbances or where sort of ultras or radical supporters are like running wild through the streets, sometimes in foreign countries. And this is something we saw happen in several occasions this past week. There were apparently a ton of Feyenoord fans, who are a Dutch soccer club with their own sort of sordid history, but apparently they were rampaging around this fountain at the bottom of the Spanish Steps, like this Bernini fountain, and they caused, apparently, initially the damages were reported to be around like 2 million euros, but apparently it was only like, I think maybe 2,000 euros. So, but like they were like peeing in the fountain. They were like leaving beer bottles over the place, like chipping parts of it. So, I mean, that was pretty bad. But even worse, unfortunately, was an incident on the Paris Metro that was captured by just like, I think this British expatriate who was just like on the platform and had a cell phone camera. Basically, what it shows is, and you see this guy like walking into the frame, this like random man from Paris, Suleiman S. I don't think his last name was released, but obviously he's a black man. He's going onto the subway, and as he's trying to get on, you know, it's pretty packed, and there are these Chelsea fans who obviously were playing at the Parc des Princes that day, so they were probably there or heading to the game. I think this was before the game, and so they're chanting various things like Chelsea, Chelsea, Chelsea. Not that imaginative of a chant. But then they start pushing this guy off, and like initially you're sort of like a little confused as to what's going on, and then he tries to get back on the train and they push him back off even harder this time, and it starts to get like really ugly really quickly. Apparently they were There were reports that they were talking about potentially like stabbing one of the people on the platform that had a Paris Saint-Germain shirt. So, I mean, it was kind of like they were just making the various threats and, you know, they end up pushing this guy off. And then sort of like before the train starts going away, they start chanting, we're racist, and that's the way we like it. And this is like a very common chant, blah, 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 that's the way we like it, or we're something, usually talking about their team name or, you know, some other adjective. And, of course, these fans have twisted it to basically have a loud proclamation of their, you know, racism and ignorance on the subway. So then, you know, the train goes away and sparks this huge incident. And for their credit, Chelsea has responded by banning some of the people identified in the video from Stamford Bridge, their home stadium, you know, just because obviously this, you know, we have their faces on video. The weird thing is, and Bill, this is the main thing I want to talk about, or just another reason to talk about this story on the podcast, is there was a former, there's a, one of the people identified, Richard Barkley, apparently works for a, like, anti-racist human rights foundation, and is an outreach worker for WAVE, which apparently is a support charity for people that were hurt or bereaved during the Troubles, which obviously, you know, Northern Ireland. But this guy is, you know, former RUC, which is a Northern Irish paramilitary police force, basically, which are known to be, you know, have a strong hooligan element, potentially racist elements. So this is not, you know, exactly out of the blue here. This guy has ties to supporters groups for Rangers, which is a, you know, this is a soccer team in, I think, Belfast, which is very heavily associated with sort of the sectarian Northern Irish. And so a lot of those fans sort of struck up a partnership with Chelsea and have become Chelsea fans in return. And they're sort of a, you know, going back to the 80s, there's a strong connection and association with the National Front, which is, you know, sort of a fascist organization within England. Obviously, we've seen the rise of UKIP in the past couple of years. So, you know, we're reaching a sort of situation, is all these little incidents of racial intolerance and racism in the world of soccer sort of bubbling up. And this past week, we actually saw an incident with the coach of the, or I think it's, I believe the former coach, the Italian national team, and he was involved in some youth team preparations, and he was, you know, found saying that there are too many black people on this team, basically, like not enough real Italians, sort of identifying the African Italians as sort of, you know, other, or not, you know, not necessarily, or not even African Italians. I think, you know, people like Mario Balotelli, they were raised in Italy, have Italian parents. So it's, you know, it's a very complex sort of issue they're trying to deal with there, especially when it comes to soccer. So, you know, you have these people spouting these racist things. You have this guy, Malky Mackay, who was caught on email and text messages saying just ridiculously racist things about, you know, Asians and just his own fans and all sorts of things. And he was basically allowed to still get a job as a manager. So you have these basically, like, little racist undercurrents that seem like it never really went away in British football. And there's almost an acceptance of it. You know, not necessarily that people aren't condemning it or they're necessarily condoning it, but it's still there and it's not quite been stamped out yet. And just another thing I want to touch on is the larger sort of concept of banter in soccer. So you have, like, fans, you know, sort of give jives back and forth to each other. Oh, it's just banter, blah, blah, blah. The thing is, when it's just banter, that, like, gives people license to basically say and do pretty abhorrent things. So you have, for example, there was just recently an incident, West Ham versus Tottenham this past weekend. So Tottenham is like a traditionally Jewish club. Like, they're, you know, they have a history in that. And then also, like, that's just sort of a casual association for a lot of their fans. And so you have, like, West Ham fans apparently on the train chanting stuff about, like, circumcision, and then, like, Adolf Hitler, he's coming for you. Stuff that is just, like, ridiculous. But then you have, like, much more insidious, like, like hissing during these things, supposed to emulate the gas chamber noises, like stuff that's just terrifying that people are even coming up with. So, you know, you have all these incidents, and I just think that, you know, people need to just take a step back and realize that just because it's quote unquote banter doesn't give you like license to just abuse, you know, using whatever sort of nasty things you can come up with other people, other, you know, whether it's other sets of fans, players. So it's just, it's really disheartening. You don't want to see that, you know, it's, I guess banter is fine, but it's, if it's giving people license to cross over into racial abuse and other types of things, it just is certainly not okay.
Yeah, now, obviously, you know, U.S. sports has its own problems with racism and that and sort of related issues. It's not perfect or anything, but it doesn't seem like we have quite the same experience with U.S. sporting teams and sort of U.S. fandom. Like, there's a lot of problems that arise out of those, but they seem to be a different set of problems. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly, or do you think that there's some similarities that I'm missing here?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe part of it is also that professional sports in America has, for the past maybe 30, 40 years, has been like, I don't know percentage-wise, but certainly sports have a predominantly, you know, black player base. Or so it's less, I feel like, less new or less uncommon to have, you know, a team mostly of black players, whereas I feel like that happening in England is much more of a recent development. You know, it's maybe in the past 10, 15 years rather than the past 30, 40. So you still have, you know, sort of this fringe that still is, you know, kind of, you know, standing against change, standing against any of these innovations. And then there's also the phenomenon people have talked about of like the 90-minute racist, people that claim that they're not actually racist, but they'll go and chant racially abusive things at a football match. So that's what you're saying. It's like, oh, it's just banter. Like, okay, well, it's not banter if you're screaming obscenities at other people. And, you know, this is, there was another instance, this is not exactly the same, but there was a TV host in Britain found to like have said off camera these like horrendously sexist, like, and offensive things. And then he's like, oh, it was just banter. It's like, well, I mean, you're not bantering with anyone. So, I mean, I don't quite get it. I mean, it's just kind of like this this Richard Barkley guy. It's like, oh, yeah, I was on the train, and I went to the match alone. I didn't participate in any chanting, and I'm not racist, blah, blah, blah. But you're still standing there behind these guys chanting, we're racist, and that's the way we like it. And you're not doing anything. And in my view, that's just almost as bad. You have people, and, you know, this was happening on social media later, but people trying to excuse this basically by saying it was almost like a sarcastic or ironic racism, basically saying that they were referencing the fact that, and this is, you know, I don't think this makes them look good, but they're referencing the fact that their captain, John Terry, was tried by the English Footballing Association for allegedly racially abusing another player on the field. And this is their captain, their idol. You know, this guy has been playing at Chelsea for at least over 10 years. I'm trying to remember the exact years, but at least possibly 15, too. And so, you know, it's almost accepted. There have been other racial incidents involving, for example, Luis Suarez that were sort of swept under the rug by his home club, Liverpool. So, you know, you have all these questionable incidents where it's sort of like, you know, there's a little bit of a hubbub and then it just sort of pushed off to the side, you know, sort of don't think about it anymore. Okay, keep cheering for Suarez, keep cheering for John Terry. Like, just because, you know, he may or may not have, and then he tries to hide behind, oh, I was just asking him if that's what he thought he called me, and, you know, just like twisting it, and, you know, it gets off on the technicality. It's like, well, we're pretty sure he called him that, but we weren't sure how it was called, blah, blah, blah. And so you're just kind of like, really? Like, I don't believe that John Terry is, you know, above calling someone that on a football pitch if he thinks that's going to, you know, get him an advantage or, you know, get under the guy's skin. So, you know, it's one thing to just, like, sort of have all these casual incidents, but it's another thing, especially with a club like Chelsea, and they're not the only ones, but to have this sort of fringe that's been a consistent part of their support going back to before they had all this money and before they had a sort of international following, back when it was sort of you know, back in the 80s, you had, you know, whether it's the Thatcherite MPs that were going to Stamford Bridge, or, you know, you sort of this National Front sort of underground current and connection between the some football hooligans and fascist organizations. So this is all worrying, and it's not gone away. You know, and it'd be wrong to say that, you know, this is representative of, you know, the majority of Chelsea supporters, or even, you know, many of them. But at the same time, we can't pretend this sort of thing doesn't exist, and doesn't exist within the sort of right-wing undercurrents of many football supporter groups, and not just in England. You know, we're talking about the Feyenoord supporters. They have a history. You talk about the, you know, whether it's Lazio, and, you know, the, whether they're making monkey noises during a football match. And this happens in Russia. This happens in all sorts of places. You know, this has happened in Spain and Italy before. So it's not like this is some new development, right? This is not new. There are bananas being thrown on the pitch all the time. You know, and it's not every match, but it happens. It happens regularly. So, you know, I don't really know the fix if it's such a widespread phenomenon.
Right. It seems to me that, you know, we have certainly people in the U.S. have strong sort of like identities toward, you know, the sports teams, especially in New England, certainly where we're both from. But, you know, a lot of it seems to be, it doesn't even necessarily match state lines evenly. Like, it's more of a media market allegiance based on what's showing on your TV. In Europe, as you've been saying, it seems to have this extra dimension, almost like that the political alignment comes first, and then as a result of your political alignment or your ethnic alignment or whatever, you then pick the appropriate team to, you know, to support like that. And it's sort of it mirrors in both directions what's going on in the wider political scene. I mean, you alluded to some of the problems in Italy and the questioning of whether or not these, you know, dark-skinned players were true Italians and that sort of thing. And that mirrors the problems just a few years ago, where you had political people in Italy, sort of local politicians, criticizing the cabinet member, the first black woman who had been appointed to the Italian cabinet, and, you know, making all kinds of, you know, racial remarks about her, saying that she should go back to the Congo and stuff like that, you know, and she's an Italian citizen and native, and just all kinds of offensive stuff. And then, you know, we see these comments in the soccer world, and similarly, you know, in Britain, you know, this, as you mentioned, there's this sort of right-wing conservatives, and there's the UKIP folks and people like that. And, you know, we've talked on previous episodes about UKIP more broadly, the United Kingdom Independence Party, and they spent, you know, the past, I would say, 2 years trying to, like, really insist that they weren't racist, and that it just happened that all of their policies had these, like, racial implications to them, but they weren't explicitly campaigning on that. And they sort of hit, like, a really strong pivot point, which I think we talked about on the previous episode, where, you know, the incident with the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, they were then kind of coming out of the woodwork to openly campaign against Muslims. But beyond that, we also saw things where, I was reading about this in The Economist, there was apparently some sort of child sexual abuse crisis that happened in some area, right? And this was, you know, many people, unfortunately, from all sorts of demographics and backgrounds have been involved in abusing children, and that's obviously terrible. But because it's happened pretty much across all demographics or whatever, it's usually has a lot less to do with their background and a lot more to do with other things, you know, power dynamics and cloistered hierarchies and things like that. But in this particular case that happened, I think there was something like 2,000 children were abused, and the abusers were, in this particular case, were of South Asian descent, I guess either Indian or Pakistani. And UKIP started running ads that said, in a labor-leaning district where a lot of people kind of like, you got these white flight concerns in the United States, a lot of white folks in Britain in these constituencies that had favored labor starting to worry that, like, labor wasn't doing enough to protect them from the scary...
Soft on Indian pedophiles.
Right, exactly. And so UKIP ran these ads that said, you know, there's 2,000 reasons never to vote labor again. And, you know, like, obviously, abuse needs to be dealt with. putting it at the feet of labor seems a little bit questionable, but it also is particularly a problem because they're basically openly saying that the, you know, refusal to deal with immigration is the reason that this happened, even though there are plenty of, you know, abuses that have happened at the hands of, you know, white Britons, natives, you know, whoever else. Anyway, I don't know all the details of that story, but that just kind of really stood out to me as this sort of transition point where the parties are kind of openly campaigning on this stuff. And, you know, I'd argue really appealing to those kind of people who are, you know, shouting racial epithets, whether it's for 90 minutes during the game or on the subway, and, you know, in another country, you know, and just kind of inexplicably doing it. And then trying to say, oh, well, we're not actually racist. And it's just like, you know, if that happened in the U.S., because I'm not saying that this kind of thing wouldn't happen in the United States. It's certainly, we've had plenty of, you know, racially charged incidents and openly racist incidents in, you know, pro sports and fandom in the United States. But if that happened in the United States, I think there would be certainly some people trying to spin it away, but there would be a lot more open condemnation of this as opposed to this sort of, as you put it, Nate, you know, maybe accepting is the wrong word, but kind of this like sense that, well, this is just the way it is. And there's always going to be this awful fringe that we can't do anything about. And, you know, then just kind of giving up essentially on trying to combat
this. Yeah. I mean,
it
seems like now it's almost reached another tipping point in the other direction. So where it's, people are finally sort of starting to realize that this is a pretty significant problem, and so at least more media attention around it. So maybe not necessarily we're going to do anything about it in the near future, but at least sort of more knowledge and sort of dissemination of these awful incidents maybe will force sort of a perspective change, where before it was sort of just thought, oh, well, you know, these are the guys that go and fight before the match. We're not going to worry about them. You know, this is just something that happens, and we need to sort of overlook it, to maybe starting to think. And there have been other incidents where, whether it was like a stabbing of a supporter before a match in Spain, you know, these various things, you sort of look at them and people maybe will start to think that there needs to be a change. Just a couple other things I wanted to touch on. Going back to Rangers, just recently there was a sort of a controversy or debate over chants that happened during, it's called the Old Firm Derby, so Celtic versus Rangers, and there's various sectarian chants that go on often during it, including one song called the Famine Song. You can sort of guess what that, where that's going, and all sorts of questionable talent or questionable songs that sort of really, you know, do we really want to keep singing those in 2015? I don't really know. But a couple, you know, just a couple other things. Going back to that, there's apparently one of the reasons that Chelsea is affiliated with Rangers, down to the point where they're even wearing blue because of Rangers. It's because of Northern Ireland IRA bombs apparently were heavily targeted in the Chelsea area during, you know, the trouble. So, you know, that's apparently a contributing factor. So you have, like, violence going back and leading to sort of deep sectarian wounds that sort of lead to these sort of festering.
And so they've aligned themselves with like hardline unionist extremists in Northern Ireland.
Oh yeah, of course. And so, you know, you have that. There was actually a really interesting documentary that I watched. It was basically like this BBC guy goes undercover, convinces the other Chelsea hooligans that he's one of them, and then sort of goes underground with them. He's like traveling and fighting with them abroad. And so, you know, it's all caught on camera that I thought he did pretty well. But apparently this guy was later, he was like apparently taking his wife had like a tumor or something. They were going to have a drink before a surgery. And then like these Chelsea guys recognized him. They started fighting him in the bar and like they hurt him. And, you know, it's all sorts of, so basically, you know, sort of the snitching type situation where they're going to come back and sort of revenge attacks against him. It's pretty crazy, but I mean, maybe think about what sort of bar you're going into after you sort of expose a bunch of these guys with rather unsavory. In fact, one of the there was an incident captured in this documentary. Basically, found one of the guys bragging about, or one of these Chelsea hooligans bragging about the time he was like stabbing a undercover police officer in the throat with a bottle, and basically like you know, giving him more once he found out that he was a undercover police officer. So you just, these are the kind of like sociopaths that, you know, find their way into the positions of leadership in sort of these hooligan elements where the point is to fight and to, you know, smash bottles at other people and potentially seriously hurt them. So, I mean, it's sort of, this is the underground that happens, you know, and it doesn't really happen in the same way in the U.S. I don't feel like there's organized fights before football games or stuff like that. I mean, maybe they happen after, but it's not quite the same.
They're not scheduling a rumble like West Side Story.
Well, there are these, I saw a YouTube video of like these guys in Russia, like slowly advancing towards each other. And then all of a sudden, once they reach each other, just like a massive brawl. And it's like, oh my God, this is what they do in Russia, apparently. So,
all right.
Film it on YouTube.
Well, we are going to have to end that segment there. You can look up more on this at arsenalfordemocracy.com. We'll be right back with a segment on Libya in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about Libya and specifically about the Egyptian intervention there. This is obviously a story that we've been covering on the show and on arsenalfordemocracy.com for the past year. This is basically playing out pretty much exactly as I had predicted, where, you know, the conflict was getting closer and closer to Egypt, and Egypt kept on having a more and more a sizable role in the situation, although covertly. Now we have arrived, as of February 16th, at the first overt, confirmed foreign policy military action by Egypt since the Gulf War in the early 1990s, as they conducted two waves of airstrikes on targets of the Islamic State in Libya. This is, you know, the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, has provinces now, three provinces, I believe, in Libya. These are not, you know, random people claiming affiliation to ISIS. These are mostly Libyan veterans who fought in the ISIS campaign to take Mosul and then went back home to Libya. They answer to Central Command in eastern Syria and seem to be pretty closely integrated. They had staged several attacks in various cities, including the capital, Tripoli, but the final sort of sparking incident was that they beheaded 21 Egyptians, Coptic Christians, on video, and this prompted the airstrikes from Egypt. Last year, we had seen some United Arab Emirates airstrikes backed by Egypt. These were not confirmed by either country. And that, you know, was certainly controversial, but those were not against ISIS. Those were against other so-called Islamic militants. There's obviously a lot of different groups operating in Libya right now. So let's just start with the immediate facts of what happened here, and then we can widen out to look at the bigger picture. Nate, we're looking at a situation where Egypt, as I said, has conducted its first military action officially confirmed since the Gulf War. This seems like a big step for Egypt. What are the implications for both countries here?
Well, I think the first thing that we should immediately note is there were large civilian casualties as a result of some of these airstrikes. Apparently, whether it was 7 civilians killed in the Libyan city of Darna, mother, children, several other people, whether it's from debris or shrapnel or whatnot. Apparently one of them was filming airstrikes from the rooftop and then got killed because of that, which is really sad. So, you know, you sort of have these civilian tragedies, you know, as a result of this. So, you know, whether that's avoidable, I really don't think so. But at the same time, you know, what will happen as a result of Egypt's sort of military advances? I mean, do you think they're going to invade full-heartedly, or, you know, you sort of just keep chipping away at Islamic State with, you know, whatever airstrikes or, you know, whether it's some troops, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of hedging, saying that they would prefer there to be a, you know, UN-authorized intervention, blah, blah. I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that within the coming calendar year we see, Egyptian ground troops officially crossing into Libya. I think that the executions kind of provided President Sisi, or General Sisi, the military dictator who's now been elected with 97% of the vote, a pretext for this sort of long-anticipated full-scale Egyptian intervention in Libya, which is next door. They, as I said, they didn't admit those engagements in Benghazi that they were supporting the United Arab Emirates. But, you know, this is not out of the realm of possibility that we see ground troops moving in, particularly to back the internationally recognized House of Representatives government, which is not a particularly democratically leaning body at this point. It's, you know, and neither is the Egyptian government. It's more anti-Islamist, I guess, is the unifying principle that is the only thing keeping together the side that Egypt supports. And the Egyptian government, also very anti-Islamist. There's another province of ISIS, so-called province, in the Sinai Peninsula now. Those are less closely affiliated than the folks in Derna, Libya, who, you know, Derna was apparently maybe the number one city in all of North Africa, if not the world, in terms of per capita people going to fight in, you know, foreign jihadist operations, whether it was ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And but, you know, the government in Egypt very clearly trying to conflate all of these things together, blurring the lines very heavily between, you know, very violent jihadist groups in the Sinai Peninsula versus Muslim Brotherhood. They sort of view it as, officially at least, as all part and parcel of the same thing. I think this execution incident also provides a way for the Egyptian government to not just rally the people to the Egyptian government like it did with Jordan and the execution of the Jordanian pilot that got Jordan back into the war in Syria. This, you know, because it's they're Coptic Christians who have felt a little bit threatened in recent years, the Egyptian government, without actually having to do anything really substantive to protect their own Coptic population in Egypt, let alone in Libya, can just say, look, we're doing this bombing thing. You have to support us. If you don't support us, you're going to all end up beheaded as well. And the irony of this, from my perspective, is that things have gotten worse for Coptic Christians under the Sisi government than they were under the Muslim Brotherhood government, which is, you know, theoretically Islamist, you know, moderate Islamist, whatever, democratically elected. And even during the Arab Spring part of the Egyptian Revolution itself, we actually saw that Coptic Christians were being protected by Muslims during prayers and vice versa. You had Christians protecting Muslims during sort of the initial uprisings 4 years ago. Like, this is a situation, I think, where the Egyptian regime is very openly manipulating the population, and I would argue openly manipulating the rest of the world. They've been kind of demanding Western action on Libya for a while. This may actually provoke some of that, although the U.S. seems to be very much still leaning back on this. Another thing that kind of came up that was surprising, that has been drowned out by these Egyptian airstrikes, was Italy calling very abruptly for a UN military intervention or NATO military intervention, and Italy saying that they wanted to lead this. That, of course, hugely controversial, because not only is Italy not really regarded as a major military power anymore, but they have that very troubled legacy of trying to invade and annex Libya and, you know, Ethiopia and other places as well. But there's a very tense history there with Libya. That's obviously a problem, and I found it very interesting that the comments calling for such an intervention led by Italy were coming from politicians in the Italian cabinet, specifically in posts like the Interior Ministry. Why would it be coming from the Interior Ministry and not foreign policy or defense or whatever? Well, probably because you've got thousands of refugees coming from Italy, I mean, from Libya, trying to get to Italy almost every day at this point. This seems like an openly sort of political move here. I think this is also going to strengthen the Egyptian regime, because we're probably going to see even more weapons sales and transfers to the Egyptians than we had been. Not only did they recently sign a deal with Vladimir Putin to get more weapons, but they also signed a deal with the French government. France has been trying to sell these fighter jets that they built like 14 years ago or something. And they've been trying to sell them unsuccessfully. No one was interested. The EU had built their own fighter jets, the Eurofighters, and France didn't want to participate in that. The US, obviously one of the bigger vendors, and they managed to persuade Egypt to buy these French jets finally. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, despite the appalling and violent record on, you know, human rights and democracy and warfare in general of the Egyptian government. This is a very unpleasant regime in many respects, you know, in terms of their conduct and their politics. I would argue that they are possibly more conservative than the Muslim Brotherhood on many issues, and a lot less tolerant, actually. You know, I think the record, you know, people are going to dispute me on that, but the record at this point, I think, stands on its own. You know, they're not openly identifying as Islamists, but they still have, you know, a constitution that is Islamic in nature and is an even harder line interpretation of Islam, I think. You know, so like ISIS is bad. This doesn't seem to really be solving the situation. This just seems to be more of a benefit to the interests of the Egyptian regime, in my opinion. I also just don't anticipate much of a Western intervention here. And I'm not sure that there should be, because, and this is the next thing that I want to talk to you about, Nate, is the idea that we talked about this on our Tunisia segment, I believe, too. But Libya does not have a large population. It's like 6 million people or something like that. Tunisia, which is a much smaller country by land area, has a larger population than Libya. And, you know, countries like Yemen is much larger by population, Iraq much larger by population, Syria much larger by population, and, you know, Libya is 6 million next door to Egypt's 80 million. I mean, the level of coverage and attention that this is getting, and the Libyan crisis in general is getting, is sort of disproportionate. Now, obviously, we're kind of contributing to that by talking about this, but I feel like a lot of the coverage hasn't provided that level of nuance of or and perspective of saying, is this, you know, situation with 6 million people, can they maybe work it out or whatever, versus, you know, Iraq or Syria or even Yemen? Like, there's the proportionality in the analysis doesn't seem to be there, and it's sort of trying to get us, you know, to re-engage in Libya as if this is, you know, tens and tens of millions of people, and there will be just total awfulness if we don't do something. I mean, Iraq, you're looking at, what, 33 million people? Like, maybe they can't work it out without help, whereas Libya, I feel like there's a little bit more opportunity to really force these sides to come together and work this out. Nate, what do you think about the way that this is being covered and kind of the pressures that are being applied to how this should be treated?
I mean, aside from the fact that you sort of have a lack of detailed media understanding and coverage of, you know, the situation in Libya, or how the sort of Libyan people in the Libyan sort of nascent state have begun developing over the past, it kind of seemed like it's dropped off in coverage ever since the end of the quote unquote war. So, I mean, that's like obviously more exciting for headlines rather than the struggles of building a nation state. So, I mean, obviously we're going to get sort of inflammatory headlines about Islamic State and the sort of atrocities they commit. But yeah, I don't think there's a detailed coverage or understanding of sort of the inter-Arab, you know, geopolitical dynamics. So whether it's, you know, shifting allegiances or balances of power in the region, whether it's, you know, the Turks or the Egyptians, I feel like there isn't a detailed understanding in the American media of how these groups relate to each other and, you know, sort of the implications of one action from one group and, you know, how that affects, you know, whether it's Israel, whether it's Islamic State, whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that we need to have a greater understanding of this and also at the same time maybe try to at least focus on it more or, you know, have this be a bigger part of the news, because this is very significant, especially if, you know, whether it's the Kurds attacking Islamic State, trying to retake Mosul, or it's the Egyptians now attacking, leading to sort of these conflicts within, you know, within the region. So, you know, this is something that we probably need to have more coverage of.
Yeah, and I think you raise an interesting point there, which is that it seems like the coverage is sort of treats it as a monolith of like,
yeah, you know, Al Qaeda is not the same Islamic State, but we don't necessarily make that distinction all the time. So.
Right. And on the flip side that, you know, oh, all of these, you know, Arab countries or all of these Muslim countries are, you know, responding XYZ ways when there is more sort of distinction and nuance within those countries.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, you've got the sort of Turkey-Qatar alliance against the, you know, Egyptian-UAE, position, whether it's on Libya or on Syria. There's these alternate alignments and this sort of debate over whether or not any Islamist democracy is allowed or whether it should all be, you know, quote-unquote liberal dictatorships, which to me seems like an oxymoron, but basically these anti-Islamist, not really democratic regimes. And it doesn't seem to take into account the sort of regional border rivalries, you know, whether it's within countries or across countries. The idea that Egypt is attacking Libya, like, doesn't account for, you know, oh, well, are there any issues between Egypt and Libya historically? Are they, you know, rivals with each other? Have they been political rivals, geographical rivals, resource rivals, things like that? Like, that's very worrying that that's not really taken into account. You know, that kind of just bothers me that, you know, it's the same thing, I guess, with sort of coverage of Kurdistan issues, where it's like, the U.S. does provide a lot of coverage to the Kurds, right, but then doesn't really acknowledge how, like, some of these actions that are happening now might then play out in terms of future implications for those countries involved, right? It seems like very, very point-based, I guess you could put it. Like, everything's very divorced from the bigger picture. It's like, oh, here's a thing that happened and no kind of context or what might happen. I mean, the fact, I think, you know, not to like be bragging here or whatever, but the fact that this is essentially playing out over the last 12 months, exactly at, like, step by step in Libya, as I've been forecasting, like, oh, if this action happens, this will then probably lead to this action or heightens the risk of that action happening, you know, and like you said, the coverage kind of disappeared from Libya, except for maybe our site and our show, until ISIS showed up in like November or so. All right, well, that's going to wrap up this segment. Nate, thank you so much for joining me in studio this week.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Arsenal for Democracy is going to be back in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me on the line from Maryland is Sasha. Sasha, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
So your most recent article on arsenalfordemocracy.com was Let's Talk Money, so let's do that. You were writing about the announcement at the end of January that the Koch brothers said they were going to spend $889 million on the 2016 presidential election. And then a bunch of other money on various other elections around the country on top of that. And you were pretty horrified by that amount of money. And then you looked into the likely effects that that will have on our democracy. So why don't we start with that perspective issue? How much is $889 million relative to other elections that we've seen in the past?
So $889 million is twice as much as Mitt Romney spent in 2012, and it's more than George Bush and John Kerry spent combined in the 2004 election. The first thing I did when we, you know, talked about writing about the Koch brothers was try and figure out how to put that number in perspective in a non-election kind of format, and I Googled, you know, what can you buy with $889 million? And the only thing that came up when you look up that number is information about the Koch brothers. So it's really kind of such an astronomically large and specific number that you can't really put it in any other form. I was thinking along the lines of, like, how many cups of coffee could I buy with $889 million? Or, like, if I laid out $889 million, like, how many times could it circle the globe? That's what I was looking for. But it's just such a large number and such an outrageous amount of money. It's kind of hard to put into a perspective that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction to this story was, you know, well, America finally has a third party. It's just the same as one of the other two. I mean, this is an astonishing amount of money.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I think it's kind of something that we all sort of expected when all of these different campaign finance laws and regulations were rolled back. And ever since Citizens United, it's been kind of a downward slope towards a huge amount of money being kind of swept into our political elections.
Yeah, I every time I see a number like this, I keep on thinking about like how many jobs these so-called job creators could actually create instead of this. I mean, if you think about what the money's going to, it's just not a productive use of
it's
money.
One job.
Right. It's well, literally yes, beyond that, like it's going to the TV networks to buy ad time, and they have to, because they're an outside group, they have to buy at a much higher rate than the actual campaigns themselves do. So it's like even more expensive than if just the campaigns directly were buying from the television stations. And, you know, it's going to pay the really expensive political consultants who are sort of managing these ad campaigns. And usually a lot of them are compensated as like a percentage of the, you know, ad buys. And it's sort of crazy to see this happening as, you know, the campaigns themselves are moving away from television, starting to wonder if television's really not the most effective, you know, direction to go and place to be spending money during campaigns. And here you've got these guys just pouring this money into, you know, paying TV executives more and consultants more to elect a president. I mean, it just doesn't seem like a productive use of money in this economy. I don't think that's what they're going for, of course.
No, obviously not. And, you know, I mentioned in the article kind of the larger scheme behind this is, you know, over the past few years, they've been pushing this money elsewhere. They've been dominating the state legislatures, and they've been working with, you know, the Republican state attorneys general to kind of overturn those environmental regulations I talked about previously. So a lot of the money is really just funneling into these states, and they're trying to build it from the bottom up. They're trying to kind of recreate that grassroots movement that a lot of the Democratic system has, and, you know, but they're doing it with money instead of more of a volunteer and like policy-based, I guess, motivation.
Right. Yeah. The Republicans traditionally have to pay a lot of their door-to-door people, you know, on the campaigns, whereas the Democrats tend to, for better or worse, get, you know, enthusiastic students and young people and retirees and anybody who's excited and has some time available to go out there and knock for free or much less money. I know some of the unions do pay people occasionally, but the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidates tend not to as often as the Republicans do. Now, you know, one criticism that gets raised a lot is, oh, why is there so much coverage of the Koch brothers? This is all, you know, a liberal media conspiracy, you know, that the focus shouldn't be as heavily on them. But you said in your post that this is significant. This is a really, you know, torrential amount of money coming from them in this one pledge for just the presidential race, because it between the two brothers, it's really dwarfing any of these, you know, liberal or even liberal leaning donors. Why don't you tell us how much money we're looking at from some of those other sources?
You're really not looking at nearly as much, I guess, you know, between, you know, like Michael Bloomberg and George Soros, they're still only getting maybe $30 million between the two of them. But in general, that's a tiny amount of money. It's about 3% of $889 million, which I just can't stop saying because it's such a large number. But in general, and that what's funny is, you know, they keep saying, you know, why are we talking about the Koch brothers so much? I'm like, well, no one else is giving that much money, and that's not even, you know, what other parts of the Republican National Committee and that sort of thing can raise. So even, you know, you have $889 million, and that's just your base. Like, they haven't even done any other kind of, you know, I mean, I'm sure they have, but just the Koch brothers and just their network is contributing $889 million. That's just separate from anything else that the Republican National Committee is going to raise or their candidate. So it's kind of, you know, it's just the cake. There isn't even icing on top yet. And I think that's just kind of absurd.
Yeah. Now, I think that, you know, there's been various sort of regulations added on, especially in the 2002 with the McCain-Feingold, that sort of reclassified how some of these different expenditures were counted. But the rise of independent expenditures really starts in 2004 with those, you know, Move On ads and the from the left and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth from the right. But even so, you know, in the years before that, right, it had been well under $10 million, I think, in most years. But for 2004, that year when it, you know, quote unquote, starts to take off, I mean, it's still a far smaller amount of money than we've seen, you know, even not counting this upcoming cycle. It was less than $20 million. I think it was somewhere around $15 million from independent expenditures in 2004. And then by 2012, we're looking at over $80 million in independent expenditures. And a lot of that is, you know, coming from the right. I mean, there's certainly some coming from the left, but still, I mean, $80 million is now going to look ridiculous compared to this $889 million.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I can't even say enough. I mean, Barack Obama spent just under $800 million in the 2012 election, and that was historically a large amount of money for any candidate to raise. And that's impressive, but what's kind of frustrating is, you know, a lot of that money was from, you know, you had your larger donors and that sort of thing, but a lot of it was small donations. Whereas with the Koch brothers, like, a lot of that money is coming from the 1%. And it's not necessarily representing the people that should be electing our president.
Right. And even if it were supposedly representative somehow, it seems a little bit odd to place that much on like the opinions of two people, right? I mean, even if they had a great track record of, you know, 20 years of amazing decisions, when you concentrate the decision making and sort of influencing of policies into that small of a concentration, like that one time they make a mistake is a big problem. And I would argue that they've made a lot of mistakes or taken policy positions that are very harmful. So, you know, it's a worry, I would say.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And that's kind of where I ended, you know, the article, where it's, you know, there are people who are working every day and they want to vote and make a difference in their elections, and they can't really, because, I mean, the amount of money being pushed into this election and thrown at candidates is just going to be absurd. And that goes, you know, on both sides. The Democrats are going to have to come up with something if they want to match that and be able to compete with that.
Or they're going to have
to go. It's kind of just, the bar just keeps getting raised, and I just think that it's just not going to end well.
Yeah.
In the long run.
Yeah. I mean, the Democrats might have to really start thinking about leaning toward the left on some policy issues, just in terms of mobilizing people that are kind of frustrated or maybe not even bothering to vote, because I don't think that going to the center to try to appeal to the Wall Street crowd is going to offset this. I don't think there's a way that Democrats can outraise the conservative side in the coming cycle. So they need to really get people excited in a way that they haven't been doing.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely going to be a little bit tricky. I mean, they have the benefit of, you know, having a Republican-controlled Congress for the next 2 years, but I think it's still going to be a little bit tricky to kind of motivate that base, like we saw in 2008.
All right. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this story.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.